For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now presents... Indie Week, the independent magazine. This issue, dated January the 9th of 2025, will be read today by John Federson. Well, into our new year now, the paper is filling out again with new articles of all sorts. So we have hard news, we have some entertainment, we have some nostalgic pieces. Whatever I have time in my 1 hour, this week's reading of the Indie Week. So here we go. We have a new governor. Governor Josh Stein took office, and he is now establishing elements of his government. And a new team within this office will be tasked with leading recovery efforts from Hurricane Helene in Western North Carolina. Governor's Recovering Office for Western North Carolina, this has got an acronym, GROW, N-C-G-R-O-W, on Tuesday, he spins up information for relief in the mountains during the first weeks of his administration. Leading that team will be Matt Calabria, who recently resigned as chair of the Wake County Board of Commissioners. Calabria, an attorney, has previously focused on workforce development, affordable housing, and public transportation. Stein said in a news release, supporting Western North Carolina is going to be an all-hands-on-deck initiative that requires a team with diverse experience and skill sets. I'm grateful to each of these leaders for prioritizing urgency, focus, transparency, and accountability as we work to rebuild the region. Other members of this new team include Emily Ganji, who worked in the Department of Information Technology and previously secured more than $1 billion in federal dollars for high-speed internet expansion. Eliza Edwards had worked in the NC Office of Strategy Partnerships and on former Governor Roy Cooper's policy team. Stephanie McGarra previously led the Pandemic Recovery Office in North Carolina and worked with the NC Area Health Education Center to address health care shortages. Holly Jones worked as Stein's Western North Carolina policy advisor while he was Attorney General and has served in elected offices in Buncombe and Asheville counties. Jonathan Krebs, who is Stein's Western North Carolina recovery advisor. Now, this team will take the lead on relief operations that is expected to take years and has garnered scrutiny as legislators and other elected officials urge transparency in spending and governance. After Stein announced a bundle of executive orders last week to expedite relief, Republican State Auditor Dave Boliak said his office would track spending and report on those orders' efficacy. Next, an article concerning Henderson Atwater, a gentleman who has been convicted last year in a series of air gun shootings and is set to spend the rest of his life in prison. A Triangle NAACP leader asks the feds to investigate this case. Mark Vasconcelos, president of the Raleigh Apex branch of the NAACP, said at a press conference last week, "The longer this injustice stands, the more we contribute to the erosion of public trust in our judicial systems." Atwater, 49, was convicted last July of 7 felony charges and several misdemeanors related to a string of drive-by BB and pellet gun shootings that took place in Holly Springs in 2020 and 2021. The shootings caused property damage and one serious injury, but no fatalities. The state's case against Atwater was marked by limited physical evidence and instances where law enforcement, in the words of Assistant District Attorney Casey Young, quote, dropped the ball, failing to document witness accounts, file police reports, or preserve evidence. After Atwater's first trial in August 2023 ended with a hung jury, Prosecutors retried the case the next year, and Atwater was found guilty. Superior Court Judge Keith Gregory sentenced him to 49 to 72 years in prison. The Raleigh Apex NAACP has been calling for federal investigation into this case for years. This time, it's directing its plea specifically to the Department of Justice Public Integrity Section, which investigates alleged misconduct by government officials. At last week's press conference, standing outside the North Carolina Legislative Building on a mild New Year's Eve afternoon, Vasconcelos delivered a 25-minute speech that, while heartfelt, sometimes lacked context and contained several inaccurate claims. For example, Vasconcelos mentioned the sole eyewitness in the case, quote, claimed Mr. Atwater shot him while operating a chainsaw, unquote, without explaining the significance of this detail. The witness testified to hearing the chick, chick, chick sound of a projectile coming at him through leaves while operating loud power equipment. Vasconcelos also claimed the prosecution relied solely on a blurry, second-hand video recording from a police officer's iPhone to convict Atwater. While his description of this footage is inconclusive, is accurate, his claim about it being the only video evidence is not. Municipal camera footage showing Atwater's vehicle, identifiable by its license plate, was captured at the site of one shooting in June of 2020. And the victim of that shooting testified that Atwater's vehicle was the one that shot at her. Vasconcelos declined to take questions at the press conference and did not respond to emailed questions from Indy. The case has received significant publicity. During Atwater's first trial, celebrities, including Amy Schumer and Kim Kardashian, shared an infographic about his indictment on social media. WRAL has provided ongoing coverage, including publishing a recording of Tuesday's full press conference. The News and Observer also published a recap of that press conference, marking the first time the paper has done any coverage of the case. There are legitimate concerns about how Atwater's prosecution was handled, including crucial evidence being lost, and prosecutors lumping together numerous incidents despite only having evidence for a few. But the tendency to oversimplify in the case, seen in both Vasconcelos' speech and the viral infographic shared by celebrities, mirrors an issue that emerged during the trials themselves. At both the initial trial and retrial, Atwater's defense attorneys opted for brief, impassioned closing arguments that left key evidence unaddressed. Atwater's attorneys filed an appeal in August, arguing that the prosecution wrongly combined unrelated cases, and that appeal is currently pending. Next article. A home-like respite stay is a new alternative to psychiatric hospitalization in Raleigh. This new kind of mental health service is available in Wake County and offers a voluntary alternative to hospitalization for people experiencing mental distress. It's called a peer-run respite house. It's the first of its kind in the Triangle area and only the third to open in North Carolina. It's designed to provide a peaceful, home-like setting where people who are experiencing behavioral health issues can stay for up to 10 nights and receive support from trained peer support specialists who are on their own mental health recovery journeys. Tucked away in a quiet, wooded neighborhood off Glenwood Avenue in North Raleigh, the new peer-run facility is a welcoming departure from a clinical atmosphere of a psychiatric hospital or emergency department. The white-painted brick ranch-style home has natural wood shutters, and its interior is bright with accents of teal, light pinks, and greens, carefully chosen from colors that have been shown to promote healing and recovery from trauma. The wood and wicker furnishings throughout the four-bedroom home are a marked contrast to the metal and plastic materials in typical psychiatric facilities. The Respite House in Wake County is operated by Promise Resource Network. That's a Charlotte-based nonprofit at the forefront of expanding peer-led mental health services in the state, including a respite house in Charlotte and a statewide peer-run warm line. The funding for the Wake County facility comes from an $835 million for behavioral health appropriated by lawmakers in the 2023 state budget, with partners including the State Department of Health and Human Services and Alliance Health. That's the regional organization that manages public behavioral health dollars. Those interested in staying at the respite house should call this phone number, 919-307-8149. That's 919-307-8149. Or email Respite Raleigh, RESPITERALEIGH, that's one word, Respite Raleigh, at PromiseResourceNetwork.org. And the 24/7 peer-run warm line, this is different from a hotline, is available for those who want to talk to and receive support from someone who has lived with mental health issues and who has experience managing them. This is an 800 number. It says follows: 1-855-733-7762. That's 855-733-7762. The goal? To reduce the need for often traumatic visits to emergency departments and psychiatric hospitals for people who feel they need help, but who might not need hospitalization. Research in other states has found that the presence of peer-staffed respite centers can reduce the need for emergency department visits for many people. Peer support specialist Elliot Brooks is excited for the new respite to open and start accepting guests in the new year. While in college, Brooks was involuntarily committed to a psychiatric facility and now believes a stay at a respite house would have been much more healing. People who have experienced forced hospitalizations can become skeptical of the medical community and may prefer the support of peers during future mental health episodes. One study conducted in-depth interviews with 40 young people who had been involuntarily hospitalized, in which the majority of participants said their experiences made them less likely to disclose future suicidal thoughts. Their distrust stemmed from their, quote, perceptions of inpatient treatment as more punitive than therapeutic, staff as more judgmental than empathetic, and hospitalization overall failing to meet therapeutic needs, the study authors wrote. NC Health News previously reported that involuntary commitments, that's illegal tool that is supposed to be used as a last resort when a person is deemed to be an immediate danger to themselves or others, rose 97% between 2011 and 2021. NC Health News has interviewed dozens of families who have had a loved one involuntarily hospitalized in recent years, and they all wished for a more therapeutic experience with more options. Peer-run respite centers were introduced in the United States in the 1990s, and Promise Resource Network's respite is modeled after one in Massachusetts called AFIYA, A-F-I-Y-A. A peer-run respite center is operated entirely by people with their own stories of mental health recovery, trauma, hospitalization, incarceration, substance use, homelessness, or some combination of these. People seeking the service arrive voluntarily rather than being forced into treatment. Unlike a psychiatric facility, Respite guests can come and go freely and are not forced to miss work or school or community events. A respite house is not meant for those who need medical care, but for someone in distress who needs a calming space and some support. Historically, North Carolina health leaders have not always invited peer support specialists to crucial mental health service meetings. They have been slow to embrace these peer-led mental health models, which have proven successful, but in other places. But the opening of the Wake County Respite and plans for more of these programs signal a shift in their approach. Kelly Crosby, director of the NCDHHS Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Use Services, has been a vocal supporter of the peer-led mental health model and called the opening of Wake County's a celebration. Crosby has said she wants to see more peer-run spaces like peer living rooms or day programs and supported places for those with mental health issues who are being discharged from hospitalization. The peer facility operated by Green Tree in Winston-Salem is one such place. DHHS Secretary Cody Kinsley said, "The department started using state funds to pay for peer support services in medical practice and hospitals around 2017. And he said, "Peers embedded in other models have the ability to gain empathy and trust with patients to help support them. We did all the hard work with the federal government to convince the value proposition, and we got Medicaid to be able to pay for it." According to Kinsley, a big reason the peer-led model has been slow to advance is that the entire healthcare system is built around a, quote, medicalized model of paying for things. Quote, "We've tried to build a track record and the credentialing process for peers to be able to make this meet muster with the federal government to say, yeah, you can pay for this as a service," he said. Kinsley said a big shift happened last year when the state legislature allocated a historic amount of funding for investments in the behavioral health system. Quote, "The state money we were able to get thanks to Medicaid expansion allows us to really supercharge that path, and so we have money like this to invest in capital buildings." Promise Resource Network has also received funding from the state to open a peer recovery hub in Wake County that's similar to the day center the organization operates in Charlotte, which offers classes and groups to support people in their mental health recovery and connect them with other community resources. Promise Resource Network plans to expand into Cabarrus County, said founder and CEO Shereen Karako, and assist with Transition to Community Living Initiative, a court-mandated order to move adults with serious mental illness out of institutions and into community settings. Karako, a trauma and suicide attempt survivor herself, is committed to delivering wellness and supporting people with mental health issues. She said her organization does not bill insurance and will remain a nonprofit with a slow but steady expansion model. "It's one house at a time," she said. "It's one program at a time. It's one community at a time." There's enough of what I call big box behavioral health. Every incentive is to serve more people and do less for them. It becomes about the bottom line, and that has served absolutely nobody. We're going to be the entity that comes along to create the alternatives that's going to be the gap filler for the things that other people are not going to have the hardiness to do that, she said. "We're not going to make the money, but we're going to make the impact. That's why organizations like ours exist, and I'm good with that." While the outgoing Biden administration has supported several alternative recovery models and launched a novel Office of Recovery, health advocates have no idea what to expect in President-elect Donald Trump's second term. Some mental health advocates are concerned about the security and longevity of their programs and fear that the Trump administration will seek to cut funding or make changes that could undermine the progress made in recent years. Kinsley, however, is hopeful. Under the first Trump administration, he recalled, there was a big commitment to the co-responder model, where mental health professionals accompany law enforcement officers to calls that involve a mental health crisis. Kinsley said, gesturing to this new respite house behind him, that gives me some sense that things will be stable. I think what I worry about is, in the haphazard effort to purportedly find savings, they cut things they don't think are valuable, especially things that are nascent like this, where we're still building out the evidence. These folks, he went on, don't have as big of a lobby or as big of an interest group to advocate for their things as much as maybe organized medicine does. And so that's maybe my light fear, but I think that's why we need to continue to just tell the story and continue to show the success. Karakow said health advocates are, quote, rightly worried about a second Trump administration, arguing that it took the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration a long time to recover from Trump's first presidency. Quote, there are some new things that have been birthed under the Biden administration, including an unprecedented Office of Recovery and a strong push for things like harm reduction and peer support, things we've been talking about and we know are effective. How open this new administration will be to either keep some of that or to continue the momentum, I think, is still to be seen. Trump's picks for key federal health positions have raised concerns among health advocates, and the potential selection of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Federal Health Department is particularly worrisome to many. He has been skeptical of some pillars of a successful public health system. Though uncertainty looms, Karako wonders if Kennedy's skepticism of the medical model could lead to a greater embrace of alternative programs, such as peer-led mental health services. She said, with RFK not being a person who centers pharmaceuticals, could there be more of those conversations that could potentially lead to practice change, that could potentially lead to policy change? I don't know. So there's a glimmer of hope and opportunity, maybe, in that. Now I do have a chance to do some a larger percentage of cultural-related articles, I'll say. First one is about Public Broadcasting North Carolina, PBS. It's got a show. It's called To Look at a State Shaped by Sound. On his way out of office, one of Governor Cooper's initiatives was to establish a new department inside the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, DNCR, the North Carolina Music Office. One of the first projects created through DNCR program Come Here and See is Shaped by Sound, a new PBS series on North Carolina's music. Over 13 episodes, Shaped by Sound will look at a wide range of artists from Wilmington to Asheville in genres ranging from R&B to country rock legacy. Featured artists include legacy acts like Superchunk, Reuben Vincent and Alice Gerard, and newer acts like Sluice, Blue Cactus, and Sonny Miles. Other featured triangle acts include Fancy Gap, Shirlette Ammons, and Mipso. Stephanie Stewart, this is one half of a local duet, Blue Cactus, says, our state is known for its rich musical legacy. John Coltrane, Doc Watson, Nina Simone, Etta Baker, James Taylor, just a tiny sliver of the guests who have called, the greats, who have called North Carolina home. but it's also a thriving, living legacy, and I'm thrilled to have a program like this that is devoted to shining a spotlight on it. Only four other states have state-sponsored music offices like this. Its formation is an effort to celebrate the state's rich musical history and bolster its creative economy. Kara Leinfelder, who's the Director of Business Development at the NC Music Office, says the governor signed his executive order on June 21st, which is International Make Music Day. We've had a lot of communities across the state celebrating Make Music Day, which was led by the North Carolina Arts Council. It was a program to recognize and spotlight how important music is to North Carolina, its contemporary history and its past, and all the rich traditions that we have here. While North Carolina boasts strong talent, the sector has struggled to regain its footing after the pandemic, with conditions increasingly difficult for artists and venues. Last month, Jay Cole announced that 2025 would be the last year that he held Dreamville, a megawatt hip-hop festival that generated around $120 million for Wake County in 2024. The announcement marked the second recent major festival exit from the Tar Heel State's capital. After many years in Raleigh, the IBMA Bluegrass Festival departed for Chattanooga, Tennessee. In 2024, Raleigh Wide Open, a homegrown music festival from Raleigh nonprofit Pinecone, will fill the bluegrass gap this next year. Shaped by Sound premiered on February the 6th, with a spotlight trained on Iron and Wine's Sam Beam, who lives in Durham. It will air on PBS North Carolina on Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. and will also be available across multiple platforms, pbsnc.org, the PBS app, and YouTube. You can find playlists of the show's music online. Stewart says she hopes that show will encourage people to turn out for live performances. Quote, as an independent artist, being part of something like this can have a significant impact in helping others in our home state and potentially beyond connect with our music. I hope that folks who watch the program will discover some of their new favorite local artists and go see them live when they come touring through their towns. Now, generally speaking, Indy and Indy Week does have coming attractions articles from all over. They're not ordinarily very specific, and for time period, this week it happens, I ran across this article, The Indy Selects What to Do in the Triangle This Week. It's a very narrow, curated list of the dozens and dozens of things that are going on just in the Triangle area this week, but I'll give you what how it's divided. To hear, Dunham's, D-U-N-U-M-S, Dunham's, that's tomorrow, January the 10th at 7 p.m., as in the Pinhook over in Durham, Dunham's. Now, I'm mentioning that I record this show on January the 9th, Thursday. So I will just give you the information about what's happening during the week that's yet to come. Dunham's released one of the Indies' favorite albums of last year, and it feels just right that the sprawling musical collective kicks off the year at the Pinhook, led by Palestinian-American musician Sijal Nasrallah. Last year's roiling I Wasn't That Thought release explored parenthood, diasporic identity, loss, love, and political change. Proceeds from this concert, again, Friday, January the 10th, 7 p.m. at the Pinhook, will go towards mutual aid for displaced Palestinians. Dunham's is joined by performances from two other indie favorites, musician Trey Charles and band Meltdown Rodeo. Altogether, this is a lineup that promises to contend candidly with our political reality and to keep singing anyway. Now we have January 11th, something to attend at the Common Market in Durham, and that's the Giant Robot Fight Club. Perhaps your New Year's resolutions have something to do with robots fighting, crafting, and public spectacle. Mine don't, but maybe yours do. Per the Durham Sports Commission website, the club is exactly what it sounds like. People dress up in created robot costumes and fight for honor and the cheers of the audience and a cash prize. Permitted do-it-yourself costume list materials include cardboard, duct tape, and foam-based materials like pool noodles and sponges. The club kicks off the year with a match at Durham's Common Market, which also has lower tenor activities throughout this week, like tipsy trivia. You can go see the market's Instagram for more. Another to attend, also on January 11th at 7 p.m. in Durham, at the Carolina Theater's Maria Bamford. There are comedians who break barriers, and then there is Maria Bamford. Anxiety, depression, OCD, intrusive thoughts, the fear of being unlovable, bouts in psychiatric units. Nothing in Bamford's own psychology seems off limits to the comedian, who performs her daring, bizarre, brainy comedy, wide-eyed and in a slightly quavering voice. This approach has proven wildly successful, with Bamford starring in a Netflix show, Lady Dynamite, and three stand-up specials. But it's no wonder why the material lands. Everyone is neurotic to some extent, and it's a relief to see it spelled out so candidly and hilariously on stage by someone committed equally to doing the work and to doing bits. All right, another one to attend in Chapel Hill at Flyleaf Books, January the 14th. Truffles and Trash is a panel on food waste in North Carolina and beyond. Food writer and UNC Chapel Hill professor Kelly Alexander, the Root Cellar Cafe and catering chef Sarah Cooney, and organizers behind Durham Community Fridges each have a unique perspective on food insecurity and waste. Alexander studied food waste solutions in Brussels, Belgium, for her new book, Truffles and Trash, Recirculating Food in a Social Welfare State. Cooney founded Feed Well Fridges in 2023 to place unsold food from local restaurants and grocery stores into free community refrigerators around Chatham County. In Durham, the Durham Community Fridges Project uses a mutual aid model to make free food available to the Durham community. In this panel discussion, they'll delve into how global problems of waste, hunger, and inequality manifest here in North Carolina, where about 10% of the population is food insecure, and what we can do about it. Finally, in this very short article on what the Indy recommends, January the 11th, again, that's coming right up, at Durham County Main Library, The Strike, looking to explore new third spaces in the new year. The Durham County Library offers a surprisingly eclectic selection of activities, ranging from story time for kids to Mahjong meetups. One solid upcoming option, the Main Library, is hosting a screening of the documentary The Strike. This film follows the story of a hunger strike at Pelican Bay Prison in 2013 that rippled through California and led to statewide protests. Following the film, a panel discussion will examine the film's themes and connects to the present-day challenges of a justice system for which the scale remains unbalanced. Public libraries, provocative art, and collective action aren't things we can take for granted. Heading into 2025, check out the screening, and if you're lucky, maybe you'll get roped into a Mahjong match afterward. Of course, this was called from who knows how long a category of articles or items available to see, hear, touch, and be present at all the time. So examine these community calendars when you have an opportunity. There'll be something for just about everyone, I'm sure. Now, one of these very more professional and higher-priced activities is the Playmakers Repertory Company over in Chapel Hill. And right now, from January 7th to the 12th, there is a play being staged there called The Shot. It's about Catherine Graham. And this is an interview with Sharon Lawrence, the woman who portrays Catherine Graham in this play, The Shot. Catherine Graham had a hell of a story. This month, that story is told at Playmakers Theater in The Shot, a one-woman play by Robin Gerber, starring Emmy-nominated actress and UNC Chapel Hill alumna Sharon Lawrence. Graham was once the most powerful woman in media, the former owner and publisher of The Washington Post, a role she took on when her husband, a troubled, charismatic journalist named Philip Graham, died by suicide in 1963. Philip Graham had inherited the newspaper from his wife's father, Eugene Mayer. Under the tenure of Catherine Graham, who also went by Cam, the Post, who went by K-K-E-Y, the Post grew from a regional to a national paper. Crucially, she also oversaw the paper's bold decision to publish the Pentagon Papers, documents revealing how the Lyndon B. Johnson administration had lied to the public about the origins of the Vietnam War, while facing active threats from the Nixon administration. There are plenty of early, eerily salient themes in Graham's story, freedom of the press, a Post at an inflection point with an oligarch now at the helm, the impact of women in power. One aspect of her story that has seen less attention, though, through biographies and following her death in 2001, movies like The Post, starring Meryl Streep, is Graham's marriage and the intimate partner violence that she experienced from her husband. Lawrence is an alumni of the UNC Chapel Hill Hussman School of Journalism and Media, ahead of The Shot's run at Playmakers, and on the heels of her off-Broadway run in Pen Pals, the Indie spoke with her about journalism, her path to the stage, and how she transforms into the beloved media mogul. So this is a Q&A. Indy, do you have female media figures you looked up to growing up? Absolutely. I had a unique perspective because my father was at WRAL-TV at the time when it was a CBS affiliate, and he had been at an affiliate in Charlotte. I grew up watching people in my own life on screen in that capacity, so it didn't seem like a bridge too far. It was attainable. By the time we got to Raleigh, which was in the mid to late 70s, they were about to hire the first female anchor they had ever had, a woman named Bobby Batista, who went on to be the first female anchor at the nascent CNN network. As fate would have it, my father was also an actor in local theaters, had gone to Northwestern to get his degree, and had done a lot on their college stage. That was part of my life, too, seeing him on stage and pursuing it as an avocation rather than a vocation. It was in my hardware because I did get his extrovert nature and my mother's voice. So I did it at Carolina, and that's where first I had a chance to be in a professional environment because of the Playmakers. And that did shift me, because for the first time, I transformed into someone else. The magic of that, the collaborative energy, the loop, the feedback from a live audience, it's something that if you are attracted to and have an aptitude for, it's very hard to resist. When you first heard about the material, it must have been thrilling to have it integrate so many worlds. When the woman who wrote the play first approached me, it was at a Women in Film event. I was very involved with Women in Film, the international organization that's been around for 50 years now, advocating for women in the entertainment business, particularly in film. I met a writer at one of our events who approached me and said she had written a play about Katharine Graham and asked if I knew who that was. Because I had studied journalism, I said yes. We immediately had that understanding that this was a conversation worth having. She asked me to read her play. Women in Film taught me to say yes to women at every stage of their creative endeavors. To readers who are new to her, how would you describe Katharine Graham? She was a woman who was privileged in that she was born into both wealth and inherent intellect, but came from a background where her father was an immigrant, and so she also understood being an outsider. She also understood the pressures of being a woman who had such drive, because she was born at a time, and so was her mother, at a time that frustrated that drive. Her leadership qualities that were obvious, not because she was seeking it, but because it was inherent in her, had to take a backseat to the mores and social constructs of the day, meaning marriage and motherhood, at a time when she had the capacity to be the leader of a media company. Her father, who owned the Post, would never have given a paper to a daughter. Her introvert nature made her an observer, and that, I think, was one of her superpowers. Her marriage was passionate and filled with love, but also with struggle. I'm curious to learn more about the marriage. First and foremost, it's important to know it was certainly documented and very public, Phil Graham's bipolar disorder. That's where the crux of the challenge in the marriage comes from. He was a very charismatic man and loved each other. But that illness is so difficult to treat, and it changes people, and it makes people versions of themselves that are not within their control. So we look at that difficulty in his psychic makeup, as well as how that affected the woman who loved him the most and the woman that he loved the most. It's documented that he had affairs. It's documented that men in that time did hold on to power. Power over women was the norm. We're telling a story that is universal. A lot of it has not changed. How did you prepare for the role? It was important to me to find the look for her, because I don't look anything like her. I don't sound anything like her, so I have to transform, and that's why it's fun for me to come back to Playmakers, where I first transformed my physical look to play Electra in The Greeks. And now that's what I do for Kay. I found a great 70s vintage shirtwaist dress that's very iconic for Kay when she was at the Post. I have my wig and my flat sort of Papa Gallo-type shoes. She was really tall, so she wore flats all the time. And I put the helmet on of her hairstyle, which is pretty iconic. It was a helmet, and she needed that armor. She needed that collar that gives the male suiting, and a very sensible, easy-to-manage wardrobe that would allow her to still stay feminine, not even feminine. Just look at the way men expected a woman to look, but also the flexibility to move quickly in the world, because that's what the media requires. I spent time listening to her. Her accent is very interesting. It's what they call a mid-Atlantic. And there is no such thing as a mid-Atlantic place, but it's a mix of what women like her, who grew up watching films with women like Katharine Hepburn, and who were taught to speak in a way that had an influence from Britain. There's a formality to it that sounds almost ostentatious, but it's not intended to be that way. It's just how those women were influenced. And there is a formality, and I believe a weight, that makes you listen to them and understand they mean business. The last question. The Washington Post is at another inflection point. We're entering another Trump administration. I'm curious what you feel is the resonance of this performance in this very specific moment we're in right now. Newspapers were so much more ubiquitous then. We're losing them at such an alarming rate, and that's because the media landscape has become not just polarized, but weaponized, which they always have been. Any kind of media can be weaponized. Yet one would hope is that in this era, Kay's era, the common person had a bit more media literacy. Their attention spans were greater. They had a choice to read and compare and understand who the owner of the paper was really speaking for and about. Now we think we know, but what are the shadows at play? When moguls own these media companies, they are beholden in a way. Kay talks about the fact it's very difficult and frightening to stand up to the government. We talk about that because she did. And I just hope the men who are in power of great media companies now are as brave and courageous and have the integrity that she did. All right, folks, I have a chance for a four-pager now all about recordings, music recordings that were admired and released during the previous year, 2024, month by month. The music editors from Indie Week collected thumbnails of the reviews of some of these records. And so there's something just about every month. And I'll read as many of them as time allows. And in January, we start with J Phono 1 release, We All Belong to Something Else. Carborough's John Harrison is known for his prolific output, usually amplified, whether it's indie rock with North Elementary, electronic improvisation with Ben Felton in Tacoma Park, or anything goes as J Phono 1. But his standout from this year, centered on the acoustic guitar, an easy stroll through the woods with friends like banjoist Nathan Bowles, pedal steel Nathan Golub, and flutist Rachel Keel. The record has a relaxed and sunny vibe, gently psychedelic, like the Beach Boys on their way down and Pink Floyd on their way up, Shaking Hands in 1970. Richly simple and autumnally content, these friendly songs will follow you like faithful hounds, asking nothing but giving all. And the next January release from Chatham County Line, Hi-Yo, as in Hi-Yo Silver. It would be a disservice to the great picker to say Chatham County Line was improved by the exit of Chandler Holt, whose brightly percolating banjo propelled that band through its first two decades. Instead, let's just call Hi-Yo's the group most unique and bewitching album to date, an example of evolution by subtraction. Filling in their newfound gaps with synthesizers, drum machines, and electric guitar, tuned to become a futuristic banjo surrogate, this group offers a warmly progressive blend of bluegrass, rock, and Americana, leaning further into the voracious musical impulses that long have set that group apart. That's Hi-Yo, H-I-Y-O, from Chatham County Line. February, from a release called Gamma from Sonny Miles. The only thing more impressive than former President Obama including Raleigh Wood Hills by soul adventurer Sonny Miles on his favorite music of 2019 list was what happened 5 years later when the promising young North Carolina vocalist and guitarist channeled all that unexpected attention into a textured debut album, Gamma, representing a composite confection of a wholly black musical canon. It's a beguiling batch of love songs wandering through the tension of fear and conceit, the longing of can't swipe away, and The Luring of Garden, Late Night Edition, both comprise a lush palette of charmed melodies that would melt any live audience. Now, if he only can be encouraged to show off his gifts on more stages. That's Sonny Miles and Gamma. In March, we heard from Gibson and Toutant on the Green, combining catchy folk-pop tunes and bulky antique tech. Durham's Gibson and Toutant, their spouses Josephine McRobbie and Joe O'Connell, sound like Yo La Tengo in a haunted Radio Shack. The great thing about On the Green is that however seriously you want to take it, it meets you there. Like the title, are we traversing a vast landscape or just stoned? When the duo sings like a dial-up modem over a touchtone phone, is this a theme on the mechanical erosion of humanity or a funny way of saying the record is about communication? This whimsical invention and sly humor make the music even more unique than it first sounds, writes the reviewer. And there's quite a bit more in March. I probably won't have a chance to do this entire article. In fact, I will just cover the titles of the releases. Teens in Trouble released What's Mine. Magic Tuber String Band released Needle Fall. And a group called Rosalie, Bite Down. Then we are in April with Sherlette Ammons and Spectacles. A black queer poet and rapper Sherlette Ammons tackles head-on the ways that being a member of those marginalized groups puts her constantly on display. In May, we heard from Bats and Mice, and they released P.S. Seriously. This Chapel Hill trio stood out among brawny post-hardcore bands about 2000 for their relative daintiness. While their songs had all the rushing highs and stomach-dropping plunges of that genre, they seemed to scamper about on pins and needles, desolately pretty, with a ringing melodic sensibility to rival indie pop peers like Death Cab for Cutie. Anyway, Bats and Mice from release P.S. Seriously came out in May. And other May releases, let's see, we had, I'm going to have to go back to that page. Oh, Rhapsody, Please Don't Cry, released in May. Rhapsody had harbored thoughts of walking away from Rap Game altogether, but they made another one. And Fancy Gap released A Fancy Gap in July. Their self-titled debut album feels like a warm summer day, even in winter. The group American Aquarium wrote The Fear of Standing Still, their 16th album. A Piedmontian Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band is the my thumbnail of that. Jake Xerxes Fussell, When I'm Called, may be the definitive Fussell album because it's the one that finds him making his chosen songs more distinctly his own. And finally, from July, the Nathan Bowles Trio Are Possible. Banjo, bass, and drummer, the nationally acclaimed trio plays Appalachian folk with the sophistication and harmony of jazz and the steely force of classical minimum. Nathan Bull's Trio Are Possible. August, Skylar Gudas, country, Durham singer, songwriter, and bandleader, just dropped a new bill of merch, a bamboo fan emblazoned with her album title. It's a perfect symbol for country. And September, we have Tescon Paul, The Longer Morrow, the name of the release. Their retro-futurist light show, kaleidoscopic polyrhythms, and occasional penchant for nighttime sunglasses. Durham, Tescon Paul is the kind of band you might glimpse in a new wave club in an 80s cyberpunk movie. In October, we've already mentioned Dunham's. Sijaz Nasrallah found Dunham's in 2009 in Palestine. And the October release was called I Wasn't That Thought. And then we had Fawn Tempol, T-E-M-P-O-L, La Oprica. With layers of psychedelic instrumentation, La Oprica is an ecstatic introductory album for avant-garde Raleigh-based duo Fawn Temple. November, XOXOX brought Jesus Peace. I love telling Keenan Jenkins' story in the indie recently, but it didn't leave room to stress just how choice the music is on this second album as XOXOX. Embracing heady, free-flowing R&B and sort of neo-retro style, Jenkins perfectly matched his voice and guitar, which are themselves alike, cool, clear, silvery, and fluid, with a sensitive band that trembles like a pool of touched water. The melodies and grooves build with exquisite patience, and the arrangements are always whooshing up or falling away to keep us rapt. Rather than being carried by the music, Jenkins' voice structures it like a trellis, seated in its elemental power. A real journey, writes Brian Howe in the concluding from the article Local Releases that the Indie Week loved in the year 2024. And I do apologize for having to skip several of the full paragraphs about all these releases. If you wanted to peruse this article again, go to indieweek.com and look under culture, and you'll see the contents complete, including links, which will often take you to the connecting areas of all of the stories that appear there. And I wish you good luck with that. And as my weekly broadcast now comes to a close, I will list the articles that I've had to put aside, possibly to get to them. One about Wake County employees, school resource police officers, and some of the foibles of having them in the schools. The story of the Stanford L. Warren Library is a beloved branch of in the IT neighborhood in Durham. There is, and how Southern Season, that foodie sensation market in Durham, met its end after many, many years supplying delicious things to the entire triangle. Well, John Feddersen must close this podcast called Independent for the Week. And we'll be back next Thursday, at least, recording the next episode. These are all found online in back into historical perspective, into the age of the dinosaurs. But in any event, we hope you enjoyed this issue, and come back and listen to some more next week. Goodbye for the North Carolina Reading Service.